This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces, by Radley Balco. This book is read by William Hughes. Introduction. There are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power, than by violent and sudden usurpations. James Madison. Are cops constitutional? That may seem like an odd question, perhaps even a little nutty. Police forces have been part of the American criminal justice system since an 8-man department was established in Boston 175 years ago, and the first large department was created 7 years later in New York City. There has never been a serious constitutional challenge to the general authority of police, or to the establishment of police forces, sheriff's departments, or other law enforcement agencies, and it's unlikely there ever would be. Any federal court would undoubtedly have little patience for such a challenge. And any hypothetical world where police were ruled unconstitutional would descend into chaos, probably rather quickly. But in a 2001 article for the Seton Hall Constitutional Law Journal, the legal scholar and civil liberties activist Roger Rootes posed just that question. Rootes, a fairly radical libertarian, believes that the U.S. Constitution doesn't allow for police as they exist today. At the very least, he argues, police departments, powers, and practices today violate the document's spirit and intent. Under the criminal justice model known to the framers, professional police officers were unknown, Rootes writes. The general public had broad law enforcement powers, and only the executive functions of the law, e.g., the execution of writs, warrants, and orders, were performed by constables or sheriff, who might call upon the community for assistance. Initiation and investigation of criminal cases was nearly the exclusive province of private persons. The advent of modern policing has greatly altered the balance of power between the citizen and the state in a way that would have been seen as constitutionally invalid by the founders. Rootes' argument may not be practical, but it's certainly provocative. On at least one point, most criminologists agree with him. No one can say for sure whether the founders would have approved of modern policing, but it's relatively certain that they wouldn't have recognized it. Criminologist and historian Samuel Walker writes in his book, Popular Justice, that in colonial America, most of the modern institutions of today's criminal justice system, the uniformed police, prisons, probation, parole, did not exist at all. The colonies did have appointed sheriffs and constables, and some also had marshals, but the duties associated with those jobs were largely administrative. Most were not salaried positions. Instead, they received fees for tasks, like serving subpoenas and collecting taxes. Since there were no fees associated with enforcing the criminal laws, for most sheriffs and constables, that task was a low priority. Sheriffs did oversee the jails, but jails were primarily used to hold defendants until trial. Incarceration as punishment was rare. Law enforcement in the 18th century was mostly a private affair. Community mores, social stigma, and shaming were the most important ways of maintaining order. Crime victims could bring their complaints to a grand jury, a panel of private citizens who had the power to indict. But the victim, or his proxy, was the party to initiate the charges. Professional, full-time prosecutors didn't exist. Under this system, enforcement of the laws was a universal duty. Every male citizen had a civic responsibility to serve on a watch, act as a constable, serve on a grand jury, or join a posse when necessary to apprehend a dangerous criminal. The word police wasn't used as a noun. It was a verb, meaning to watch over or monitor the public health and safety. This isn't to say that the colonial era's more individualized, private methods of law enforcement would work today. As American towns grew from close-knit communities of people of similar ethnicities, with shared traditions, values, and religion, to cities whose diverse populations of immigrants had none of that in common, centralized police forces emerged to preserve order and enforce a common set of laws. Once neighbors stopped speaking the same language and worshiping in the same buildings, shunning and social stigmatization lost their effectiveness. Even so, Roots's question is a useful starting point for this book because it shows just how far we have come. The founders and their contemporaries would probably have seen even the early 19th century police forces as a standing army, and a particularly odious one at that. Just before the American Revolution, it wasn't the stationing of British troops in the colonies that irked patriots in Boston and Virginia. It was England's decision to use the troops for everyday law enforcement. This wariness of standing armies was born of experience and a study of history. Early American statesmen like Madison, Washington, and Adams were well versed in the history of such armies in Europe, especially in ancient Rome. If even the earliest attempts at centralized police forces would have alarmed the founders, today's policing would have terrified them. Today in America, SWAT teams violently smash into private homes more than 100 times per day. The vast majority of these raids are to enforce laws against consensual crimes. In many cities, police departments have given up the traditional blue uniforms for battle dress uniforms modeled after soldier attire. Police departments across the country now sport armored personnel carriers designed for use on a battlefield. Some have helicopters, tanks, and Humvees. They carry military-grade weapons. Most of this equipment comes from the military itself. Many SWAT teams today are trained by current and former personnel from special forces units, like the Navy SEALs or Army Rangers. National Guard helicopters now routinely swoop through rural areas in search of pot plants and, when they find something, send gun-toting troops dressed for battle, rappelling down to chop and confiscate the contraband. But it isn't just drugs. Aggressive SWAT-style tactics are now used to raid neighborhood poker games, doctor's offices, bars and restaurants, and head shops, despite the fact that the targets of these raids pose little threat to anyone. This sort of force was once reserved as the last option to defuse a dangerous situation. It's increasingly used as the first option to apprehend people who aren't dangerous at all. There's now a dominant military culture within modern police agencies. Go to one of the many SWAT conferences and SWAT team competitions held throughout the year, and you will find exhibit halls teeming with military weapons, gear, clothing, and imagery. The vendors at these events know their market. They use war imagery to ply their goods, because that's what makes cops and police departments want to buy them. Many sell the same products to both the military and civilian police agencies. In the 1990s and 2000s, the company Heckler & Koch marketed its MP5 semi-automatic weapon with the slogan, "From the Gulf War to the Drug War, Battle Proven." Publications like Larry Flint's SWAT magazine feature ads that emphasize knocking heads and kicking ass, and print articles with headlines like "Go for the Throat" and "Warrior Mindset." There's been nothing secretive about this transformation, but because it's been unfolding over several decades, we don't seem to have noticed. On February 11, 2010, in Columbia, Missouri, the police department's SWAT team served a drug warrant at the home of Jonathan Whitworth, his wife, and their 7-year-old son. Police claimed that 8 days earlier they had received a tip from a confidential informant that Whitworth had a large supply of marijuana in his home. They then conducted a trash pull, which turned up marijuana residue in the family's garbage. That was the basis for a violent, nighttime, forced entry raid on the couple's home. The cops stormed in, screaming, swearing, and firing their weapons. and within seconds of breaking down the door, they intentionally shot and killed one of the family's dogs, a pit bull. At least one bullet ricocheted and struck the family's pet corgi. The wounded dogs whimpered in agony. Upon learning that the police had killed one of his pets, Whitworth burst into tears. The Columbia Police Department SWAT team recorded many of its drug raids for training purposes, including this one. After battling with the police over its release, a local newspaper was finally able to get the video through state open records laws and posted it to the Internet. It quickly went viral, climbing to over 1 million YouTube views within a week. People were outraged. The Columbia Police Department was swamped with phone calls and emails, and its officers were condemned, cursed, and scolded. Some even received death threats. The video also made national headlines. On Fox News, Bill O'Reilly discussed it with newspaper columnist and pundit Charles Krauthammer, who assured O'Reilly's audience that botched raids like the one in the video were unusual. He warned viewers not to judge the war on drugs based on the images coming out of Colombia. Krauthammer was wrong. This was not a botched raid. In fact, the only thing unusual about the raid was that it was recorded. Everything else, from the relatively little evidence to the lack of a corroborating investigation, the killing of the dog, the fact that the raid was for nothing more than pot, the police misfiring, and their unawareness that a child was in the home, was fairly standard. The police raided the house they intended to raid, and they even found some pot. The problem for them was that possession of small amounts of pot in Colombia had been decriminalized. They did charge Whitworth with possession of drug paraphernalia for the pipe they found near the marijuana, a $300 fine. The reaction to the video was fascinating and perhaps encouraging, because, again, the raid itself was indistinguishable from the tens of thousands of similar raids conducted each year in America. It was as if the country, or at least the Internet generation, was for the first time seeing firsthand on-the-ground footage of the way the drug war is fought every day, and they found it terrifying. Most Americans still believe we live in a free society and revere its core values. These principles are pretty well known. Freedom of speech, religion, and the press, the right to a fair trial, representative democracy, equality before the law, and so on. These aren't principles we hold sacred because they're enshrined in the Constitution, or because they were cherished by the founders. These principles were enshrined in the Constitution and cherished by the framers precisely because they're indispensable to a free society. This book answers the question, how did we get here? How did we evolve from a country whose founding statesmen were adamant about the dangers of armed, standing government forces? A country that enshrined the Fourth Amendment in the Bill of Rights and revered and protected the age-old notion that the home is a place of privacy and sanctuary, to a country where it has become acceptable for armed government agents dressed in battle garb to storm private homes in the middle of the night, not to apprehend violent fugitives or thwart terrorist attacks, but to enforce laws against nonviolent, consensual activities. How did a country pushed into a revolution by protest and political speech become one where protests are met with flash grenades, pepper spray, and platoons of riot teams dressed like robocops? How did we go from a system in which laws were enforced by the citizens, often with non-coercive methods, to one in which order is preserved by armed government agents, too often conditioned to see streets and neighborhoods as battlefields, and the citizens they serve as the enemy? Before we begin, a few organizational notes are in order. First, this is not an anti-cop book. Although it includes plenty of anecdotes about bad cops, there were plenty of good cops. Some of them are interviewed in this book. The fact is that we need cops, and there are limited situations in which we need SWAT teams. If anything, this is an anti-politician book. Bad cops are the product of bad policy, and policy is ultimately made by politicians. A bad system, loaded with bad incentives, will unfailingly produce bad cops. The good ones will never enter the field in the first place, or they will become frustrated and leave police work, or they'll simply turn bad. At best, they'll have unrewarding, unfulfilling jobs. This book explores the consequences of having cops who are too angry and too eager to kick down doors and to approach their jobs with entirely the wrong mindset, but with an eye toward identifying and changing the policies that allow such people to become cops in the first place, and that allow them to flourish in police work. Second, some of this book is the product of historical research. Some of it is original reporting done exclusively for the book, and some of it is original reporting I've done for other publications. Many of the passages taken from reported pieces I've already published are reprinted here verbatim, or nearly verbatim. Finally, many of the anecdotes mentioned in the book happened years or decades ago. Sometimes there was a flurry of initial coverage of an incident, but then no coverage of the resolution. I've tried to find out how all of these incidents were resolved, but that wasn't always possible. For example, an anecdote may have come from a complaint in a lawsuit against a police department that was resolved with a closed settlement, which means the police account of the incident was never revealed. Or a police department may have refused to disclose information about an internal investigation, leaving only press accounts of an incident. In cases like these, I've indicated the source of the accusations to let you know that they're one-sided narratives. This story of police militarization in America begins with lessons from ancient Rome, then moves quickly through the dark and Middle Ages into the origins of modern policing. We examine the foundations of the American experiment laid down during the colonial period and the American Revolution, the right to privacy, the castle doctrine, and the demilitarization of free societies. Then look at the emergence of the modern, centralized police department in the early 19th century. After quickly passing through the Progressive Era, the professionalization movement, and alcohol prohibition, we come to the real beginning of the story of modern police militarization, the social upheaval, civil unrest, and culture wars of the 1960s. At that point, the book becomes a more focused narrative. We follow the militarization trend through Nixon's rhetorical wars on crime and drugs in the 1970s, Reagan's all-too-literal drug war of the 1980s, and the massive expansion of SWAT teams, the proliferation of military gear, and the federalization of policing in the 1990s. The final chronological chapter looks at how the war on terrorism has accelerated the militarization of the police, how SWAT teams and the paramilitary approach to policing have moved beyond the wars on drugs and terror, and how frighteningly willing the government has become to use this sort of force to make a political statement. The book ends with a chapter on reforms and recommendations on how to roll back the militarization of policing in America, and whether any meaningful reform is still possible. Chapter 1. From Rome to Ritz. Quis custodiet ipsos custodes? Who will watch the watchers? Juvenal. First-century Roman poet. Given that most of the American founders were students of the Enlightenment and its revival of classical learning, most of them looked fondly on the Roman Republic and drew lessons from the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, for example, wrote the Federalist Papers under the pen name Publius, in honor of the first consul of the Roman Republic, and one of the revolutionaries who overthrew the monarchy. John Adams, in particular, was a fan of Cicero, who spent much of his public life warning of the dangers of militarism and dictatorship, and was eventually murdered for it. The American forefathers were keenly aware of the price that Rome paid by permitting the military to gain such power in their society, and they generally sought to avoid its mistakes. It seems fitting, then, that the world's first documented, organized police force would have been established in ancient Rome. And the rise of that ancient police force raised many of the same questions about balancing security with liberty that we debate today. After Julius Caesar was assassinated in 44 BC, Rome fell into chaos as the empire's powerful factions maneuvered to seize power. Anticipating bloodshed, faction leaders began to pull elite troops from their armies to serve as bodyguards. These guard units came to be called Praetorian cohorts, after the Praetoria cohorts, who guarded the tents of Roman generals during war. By the end of the reign of Emperor Augustus, and for the next several centuries, the Praetorian Guard would take on more of the roles we now associate with a conventional police force, including investigating serious crimes, making arrests, providing security during Colosseum games, collecting taxes, spying on suspected revolutionaries, collecting undercover intelligence, and even fighting fires. During his reign, Augustus established two other policing forces less prestigious than the Praetorians. Around 13 BC, he created the Cohortes Urbaniae, or urban cohorts, which he charged with quelling riots and keeping order in the streets. And in AD 6, he created an additional order called the Vigiles. First charged exclusively with fighting fires, the Vigiles would also later take on police duties, and came to serve as Rome's night watchmen. Augustus's Praetorian Guard would eventually become one of the most powerful institutions in Rome. In later years, the Guard's loyalty often determined who would become the next emperor, and its members may have assassinated as many as a dozen Roman emperors, and many more potential heirs. The interesting thing about Augustus's first police forces is that, to implement them, he had to navigate some of the same challenges and objections to civic policing that arise today. He had to balance public safety and the maintenance of order by at least appearing to respect civil liberties. More importantly, he had to find ways to assure the Senate and the citizenry that the responsibilities of these bands of order-keeping public servants, all drawn from the Roman army, were distinct from the duties that Romans normally associated with soldiers. Even in ancient Rome, the public was acutely sensitive to the threat of militarized policing. Prior to Caesar's march on Rome in 49 BC, soldiers were forbidden to enter the capital as soldiers. There had never been a permanent standing army within the city. It was Caesar's crossing of the Rubicon, the city's outer boundary, with his army, that triggered the civil war that ended the Republic. After Augustus, the Praetorian Guard became an increasingly powerful force in the upper echelons of Roman power. As conquest and empire became central tenets of Roman society, the day-to-day lives of Romans became infused with militarism. Soldiers and generals began to be held in higher esteem than scholars and statesmen. The Praetorian Guard outgrew its consignment under Augustus to civilian policing and was reconnected with the Roman army. Eventually, the Guard directly interfered with the succession of emperors, sowing further instability. The Praetorian Guard was finally disbanded by Emperor Constantine in AD 312. Its members had made the mistake of backing his opponent. About 1,800 years would pass before the world would see another metropolitan police force as centralized and organized as those that Augustus first established in Rome. There were also some broader parallels between Rome and the establishment of policing in the modern world. During the Roman Republic, disputes were settled between and within families. Criminals were often punished by their own relatives, who faced social pressure to make right by victims and their kin. But under Augustus, the state began to take on a much larger role in these traditionally private and provincial affairs. As Rome was transformed from republic to empire, dispute resolution, punishment, and remuneration, which had once been handled privately, fell exclusively to the emperor's executive power. As we will see, Britain and the early United States went through a similar transition centuries later. In the United States, the colonial era concerns about standing armies gave way to more immediate problems, like crime and rioting, as the country moved into the industrial age. Cities turned to centralized power, police agencies reporting to the mayor to impose law and order. In the years that followed Rome's fall, organized policing largely disappeared from Europe. One exception were the few cities in Italy that became hubs of trade and culture. As they grew, cities like Florence and Venice had to contend with urban issues of crime, poverty, and disease. To keep order, which kept the trade flowing, leaders established patrols to protect the property of businesses, tradesmen, and manufacturers, and to enforce curfews during outbreaks. By the Middle Ages, a nationalized police force had emerged in France, though more as an effort to protect the monarchy from revolt than to protect the citizens from crime. Maintaining the existing order was the only priority. Civil liberties were of little concern. The English tradition was different. Because of its isolation, England was relatively more stable than continental Europe during the Dark and Middle Ages. It didn't face the constant threat of revolution. Ruling regimes in other parts of Europe had to maintain order by suppressing dissent and keeping the public from posing a threat to them. In Britain, preserving order meant protecting lives, rights, and property from thieves, vandals, and murderers. Consequently, the English benefited from an orientation toward local rather than centralized policing. Before the Norman conquest of 1066, Britain was organized into taifings, groups of about 10 families in a given geographical area who were expected to maintain peace and order on their land. If a member of a taifing committed a crime, the group was expected to turn the transgressor over to the king, or the taifing would be punished as a group. Groups of 10 taifings were then grouped into larger units called shires. To keep order in the shires, the crown appointed a representative called a reeve, a position usually filled by one of the shire's own residents. The position came to be called the shire reeve, the source of our modern word sheriff. This mix of incentives for tithings enabled them to maintain order with a balance of liberty and accountability. The English system also benefited from its adherence to common law rather than Roman law. Because the objective of common law is dispute resolution rather than enforcing the will of the sovereign, it offers more protection of individual rights. English citizens' ability to sue law enforcers who violated their rights was unheard of in countries with centralized policing forces. English trials were also governed by set rules of procedure, again, in stark contrast to the rest of Europe. Some of that began to change after the Norman conquest. The Normans used the existing traditional English structure to impose a more centralized system, like those on the continent. Sheriffs became more beholden to the crown, and the Normans introduced the position of constable, which would come to replace the sheriff as the crown's preferred local law enforcement officer. Still, while the Normans made some important changes to the way British society kept order, the tradition of common law rule, trials with set procedures, and individual rights was too ingrained to be overcome. As with Imperial Rome and Italy in the Middle Ages, urbanization in England eventually created the need for a new system. By the 14th century, as England grew more populous and industrialized, the tithing system grew less useful. Social pressure lost its effectiveness in keeping order as English citizens came to live closer together, next to neighbors they didn't already know. In response, Parliament authorized the position of urban constable to keep order. Constables were permitted to draft citizen watchmen to patrol city streets at night and raise the hue and cry to call up all men between ages 15 and 60 in the event of an emergency. By the early 18th century, England, and London in particular, had thoroughly outgrown its antiquated system of preserving order. London at the time held 10% of the country's population within its city limits. The streets, overrun with highwaymen, pickpockets, and burglars, were growing more dangerous. The constables and their deputies were overworked and easily corrupted. In more affluent areas, magistrates could afford to hire thief-takers, freelance crime-fighters who would capture crooks in exchange for a bounty. But crime persisted, and British officials would soon be forced to look for a better solution. The American experience was shaped by the lessons from the classical period, by Enlightenment ideas about the proper relationship between the people and the state, by English common law, and of course by the colonists' direct experience with British rule. Among the most crucial concepts inherited from these traditions was a term that has since lost a great deal of its original meaning, the Castle Doctrine. When used today, the term is most often associated with the gun control debate, but it means a great deal more to the impulses that shaped our national ideas about privacy, liberty, and the proper relationship between the individual and the state. Ironically, America both inherited the Castle Doctrine from British common law and was moved to revolution, in part, by Britain's refusal to honor the principle in the colonies. Put simply, the Castle Doctrine holds that a man's home is his castle, but it springs from an older, much broader sentiment that the home should be protected as a place of refuge, peace, and sanctuary. One of the earliest recorded pronouncements of the idea came from the Roman statesman Cicero. Quid enim sanctius, quid omni religioni municius, quam domus unus quisque civium. What more sacred, what more strongly guarded by every holy feeling than a man's own home? Implicit in the sentiment is not only the right to repel criminal intruders, but also the idea that the state is permitted to violate the home's sanctity only under limited circumstances, only as a last resort, and only under conditions that protect the threshold from unnecessary violence. Thus, before entering without permission, government agents must knock, announce and identify themselves, state their purpose, and give the occupants the opportunity to let them in peacefully. The Castle Doctrine establishes the home as a sanctum in which a citizen can expect to be let alone, a principle that the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis called the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized men. The Castle Doctrine was probably first formally invoked in common law in Simmain's case in 1572. It has been a right recognized and protected by British law ever since. In 1762, the barrister and English legal scholar William Hawkins wrote, "Where one lies under a probable suspicion only and is not indicted, it seems the better opinion at this day that no one can justify breaking open doors in order to apprehend him." Even among those commentators on English law who thought the king could break into a private home, it was generally accepted that he could do so only after knocking, announcing, and giving the residents time to grant entry and avoid violence. The 17th century English judge and barrister Matthew Hale wrote, "But the breaking of an outer door is, in general, so violent, obnoxious, and dangerous a proceeding that it should be adopted only in extreme cases, where an immediate arrest is requisite." The 1757 English trial of Richard Curtis litigated Castle Doctrine principles that would resurface in drug-related cases in the United States 2 centuries later. Curtis was charged with the murder of a sheriff who had come to his home with an arrest warrant and forced entry without first announcing himself. In his defense, Curtis argued that he had no way of knowing that the man breaking into his home was an officer of the law. The court sided with Curtis, ruling that peace officers could break open a door only after having demanded admittance and given due notice of their warrant. The subject of the warrant had to be given notice that the officer cometh not as a mere trespasser, but claiming to act under a proper authority. The announcement requirement under English law was not a formality, as it has become in police raids carried out today. It was elemental. Its purpose was to give the homeowner the opportunity to avoid violence, distress, and the destruction of his property. A quick knock and announcement in the middle of the night, followed by forced entry 10 to 15 seconds later, before anyone inside can wake, come to the door, and peacefully grant the sheriff entrance, would be only slightly less offensive to the doctrine's spirit than not knocking at all. As we'll see, while the U.S. Supreme Court still recognizes the Castle Doctrine, thanks to the modern drug war, the court has all but abandoned this idea that the doctrine should protect homeowners from unnecessary violence, which has historically been the entire reason for its existence. Not all English legal traditions were carried on in the United States, of course, but the evidence of the founders' reverence for the Castle Doctrine is overwhelming. When English authorities began to trample on the principle, the colonists were first moved to protest, then to try to protect themselves through their own courts and legislatures, and finally to openly revolt. The real confrontation started in 1760, when England instituted a battery of unpopular taxes and import restrictions on the colonies. Many colonists took to smuggling to avoid paying new taxes on imported goods. The British then responded with heavy-handed laws to move against the smugglers. Then, as now, the authorities were required to get warrants before searching private property. But it was the general warrant that infuriated the colonists. General warrants lack specificity. They grant broad authority to search broad groups of people for evidence of any number of crimes, sometimes over long stretches of time. The variety of general warrant that Britain used to enforce the import and tax laws on the colonists was called the Writ of Assistance. The policy had been authorized by the British Parliament in the 1660s, but it was rarely used in England. Beginning in the 1760s, however, it became an effective way to combat smugglers and tax scofflaws. Writs of Assistance gave customs officials the power to enter private homes, search for smuggled or untaxed goods, and command other government officials, and even private citizens, to assist them. In some ways, the writs were less intrusive than today's drug warrants. Writs could not be exercised at night, for example, and authorities still had to knock, announce, and allow sufficient time for residents to grant them entrance before breaking down a door. But in other ways, writs of assistance granted government officials more sweeping powers than any warrant today. A writ holder had the power to search any building or residence and confiscate any suspected contraband. And once issued, a writ was essentially permanent. It remained valid until 6 months after the death of the king in power when it was issued. The colonists despised the writs, particularly in port cities like Boston, the hub of revolutionary fervor. The Massachusetts legislature banned general warrants in 1756, but that prohibition didn't stop the English from issuing and enforcing them. Aggrieved Bostonians soon found a champion in James Otis, Jr., a blustery Boston attorney who had just resigned as Advocate General of the Admiralty Court, the court with jurisdiction over the ships importing goods, in protest against the abuses wrought by the writs. When Otis resigned, began advocating against the writs, and offered free legal representation to anyone who wanted to challenge their legality, he attracted attention in both Boston and London. In 1761, Otis agreed to represent a group of prominent Boston merchants challenging the writs in Paxton's case. The case was likely to be a loser. British law was fairly settled on the matter. But Otis and the plaintiffs hoped to use the case to stir up opposition. When the trial came, Otis used the court proceedings as his platform to deliver an impassioned, wide-ranging, 5-hour polemic against the practice of general warrants. In one passage, he called writs of assistance the worst instrument of arbitrary power, the most destructive of English liberty, and the fundamental principles of law that ever was found in an English law book. Otis invoked natural rights, the Magna Carta, and the Castle Doctrine. Now, one of the most essential branches of English liberty is the freedom of one's house. A man's house is his castle, and whilst he is quiet, he is as well guarded as a prince in his castle. This writ, if it should be declared legal, would totally annihilate this privilege. Custom House officers may enter our houses when they please. We are commanded to permit their entry. Their menial servants may enter, may break locks, bars, and everything in their way. And whether they break through malice or revenge, no man, no court can inquire. Bare suspicion without oath is sufficient. As expected, Otis lost in court, but his speech likely changed the course of history. One member of the courtroom audience that afternoon was John Adams, a 25-year-old lawyer who would become the second president of the United States of America. Later in his life, Adams recalled the impact that Otis's speech had on him. He praised Otis's grasp of history and fiery defense of the rights of man, and pointed out that, quite ahead of his time, Otis even declared that black men should be afforded the same rights as white men, including the right to own property. Adams credited Otis and his diatribe against the British warrant abuses as the first knocks of the American Revolution. Every man of an immense crowded audience appeared to me to go away as I did, ready to take arms against writs of assistance, Adams wrote. Then and there was the first scene of the first act of opposition to the arbitrary claims of Great Britain. Then and there, the child, independence, was born. Writs of assistance and the customs bureaus that carried them out would be among the specific complaints that the signers of the Declaration of Independence laid out against King George III on July 4, 1776. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. In 1791, the Castle Doctrine was enshrined in the U.S. Constitution when the Fourth Amendment was ratified with the rest of the Bill of Rights. The Fourth Amendment prohibits general warrants at the federal level. The prohibition would later be extended to the states through the 14th Amendment. By requiring that warrants not be issued without reason and probable cause, that they be sworn with an oath and affirmation, and that they include particular information about the place to be searched and the person and items to be seized. But the Fourth Amendment was just one part of a larger, ongoing debate about how to police and defend the security of a free society. The country was young, untested, and unstable, and it faced hostile threats, both internal and external. Those threats would test early America's devotion to individual rights and the Enlightenment principles that had animated the fight for independence. Chapter 2. Soldiers in the Streets. One of America's greatest strengths is that the military is responsive to civilian authority, and that we do not allow the Army, Navy, and the Marines and the Air Force to be a police force. History is replete with countries that allowed that to happen. Disaster is the result. Marine Lieutenant General Stephen Olmsted, in his 1987 testimony before the U.S. Congress. The Third Amendment reads in full, "No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law." You might call it the runt piglet of the Bill of Rights amendments. Short, overlooked, sometimes the butt of jokes. The satirical news site The Onion once mocked it with an article about a Third Amendment advocacy group and its record 191-year fight to keep the amendment intact. The group's motto, "Keep the fat hands of soldiers out of America's larders." The Supreme Court has yet to hear a case that turns on the Third Amendment, and only one such case has reached a federal appeals court. There have been a few periods in American history when the government probably violated the amendment, and on a large scale, but those incursions into quartering didn't produce any significant court challenges. In the War of 1812, for example, federal troops were quartered in private homes by the thousands, and quartering was also widespread during the Civil War. On both occasions, the quartering was neither authorized nor prescribed by Congress. During World War II, U.S. military forces stationed themselves in the homes of Aleutian Islanders in preparation for an anticipated attack by Japan. though it is likely that the government overstepped its authority in all of these instances. They failed to produce any work for the Supreme Court to hash out the amendment's protections and exceptions. Not surprisingly, then, Third Amendment scholarship is a thin field, comprising just a handful of law review articles, most of which either look at the amendment's history or pontificate on its obsolescence. Given the apparent irrelevance of the amendment today, we might ask why the framers found it so important in the first place. After all, citizens were made to sacrifice for national defense in ways far more intrusive. The Constitution allows for conscription, for example, and the Continental Army openly seized property, like livestock and food, from colonists. Why, then, was quartering so despised? One answer returns to the castle doctrine. If you revere the principle that a man's home is his castle, it hardly seems just to force him to share a portion of it with soldiers, particularly when the country isn't even at war. But the historical context behind the Third Amendment shows that the framers were worried about something more profound than fat soldiers' hands stripping the country's larders. The amendment was a placeholder for the broader aversion to an internal standing army. At the time the Third Amendment was ratified, the images and memories of British troops in Boston and other cities were still fresh, and the clashes with colonists that drew the country into war still evoked strong emotions. What we might call the symbolic Third Amendment wasn't just a prohibition on peacetime quartering, but a more robust expression of the threat that standing armies pose to free societies. It represented a long-standing, deeply ingrained resistance to armies patrolling American streets and policing American communities. And in that sense, the spirit of the Third Amendment is anything but anachronistic. As with the Castle Doctrine, colonial America inherited its aversion to quartering from England. British opposition to the practice dates back to the decade after the Norman Conquest, when King William first stationed a permanent army in England for national defense. To raise soldiers for an army, subsequent kings would often pardon killers and thieves, conscript them into military service, then billet them in towns and cities. As you might imagine, giving criminals weapons and the authority of soldiers, then billeting them among the population, brought some problems. Opposition to quartering persisted for centuries, culminating with a ban on the practice in the English Bill of Rights, signed by William and Mary in 1689. Appreciation of the problems associated with putting soldiers among the citizenry ultimately carried over to the New World, just as the Castle Doctrine did. And as with the Castle Doctrine, England wasn't nearly as respectful of the principle in the colonies as it was at home. The first significant escalation of the issue came in the 1750s, when the British sent over thousands of troops to fight the Seven Years' War, known in the United States as the French and Indian War. In the face of increasing complaints from the colonies about the soldiers stationed in their towns, Parliament responded with more provocation. The Quartering Act of 1765 required the colonists to house, feed, and supply British soldiers, albeit in public facilities. Parliament also helpfully provided a funding mechanism with the hated Stamp Act. Protest erupted throughout the colonies, both in the streets and in the legislatures. Some protests spilled over into violence, most notably the Boston Massacre in 1770. England only further angered the colonists by responding with even more restrictions on trade and imports, the laws that customs officials used general warrants to enforce. Parliament then passed a second Quartering Act in 1774, this time specifically authorizing British generals to put soldiers in colonists' homes. There were no wars going on at the time. The law was aimed squarely at correcting the colony's insubordination. England then sent troops to emphasize the point. It was the deployment of British soldiers to colonial cities, strictly for the purpose of enforcing the law, that set long smoldering hostilities aflame. Using general warrants, British soldiers were allowed to enter private homes, confiscate what they found, and often keep the bounty for themselves. The policy was reminiscent of today's civil asset forfeiture laws, which allow police to seize and keep for their departments cash, cars, luxury goods, and even homes, often under only the thinnest allegation of criminality. Quartering itself, the specific burden of giving up a bed to a soldier, feeding him and clothing him, was not what edged cities like Boston to the brink of war. The actual quartering of British troops in the private homes of colonists was rare, at least up until the start of the American Revolution. It was the predictable fallout from positioning soldiers trained for warfare on city streets among the civilian populace and using them to enforce laws and maintain order that enraged colonists. Contemporary newspaper accounts documented frequent and increasingly bitter altercations between soldiers and citizens. Bostonians were British subjects, but they were being treated like enemies of the state. They began to interpret the stationing of troops in their city as an act of war. After the American Revolution, the leaders of the new American Republic had some difficult decisions to make. They debated whether the abuses that British soldiers had visited upon colonial America were attributable to quartering alone or to the general aura of militarism that came with maintaining standing armies in peacetime, and whether restricting, prohibiting, or providing checks on either practice would prevent the abuses they feared. Anti-Federalists like George Mason, Patrick Henry, Sam Adams, and Elbridge Gerry opposed any sort of national army. They believed that voluntary civilian militias should handle issues of national security. To a degree, the Federalists were sympathetic to this idea. John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison had all written on the threat to liberty posed by a permanent army. Even Alexander Hamilton, the most Federalist of the Federalists, presciently warned about the temptation to sacrifice liberty at home for security from outside threats. The violent destruction of life and property incident to war, the continual effort and alarm attendant on a state of continual danger, will compel nations the most attached to liberty to resort for repose and security to institutions which have a tendency to destroy their civil and political rights. To be more safe, they, at length, become willing to run the risk of being less free. But the Federalists still believed that the federal government needed the power to raise an army. Those same liberties faced a greater threat from outside forces and were likely to be obliterated entirely if the young nation was conquered by a foreign power. In the end, the Federalists won the argument. There would be a standing army. But protection from its potential threats would come in an amendment contained in the Bill of Rights that created an individual right against quartering in peacetime. Even during wartime, quartering would need to be approved by the legislature, the branch more answerable to the people than the executive. Taken together, the Third, Second, and Tenth Amendments indicate the founders' desire for the power to enforce laws and maintain order to be primarily left with the states. As a whole, the Constitution embodies the rough consensus at the time that there would be occasions when federal force might be necessary to carry out federal law and dispel violence or disorder that threatened the stability of the Republic, but that such endeavors were to be undertaken cautiously and only as a last resort. More importantly, the often volatile debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists shows that the Third Amendment itself represented much more than the sum of its words. The amendment was, in some ways, a compromise, but it reflects the broader sentiment shared by both sides about militarism in a free society. Ultimately, the founders decided that a standing army was a necessary evil, but that the role of soldiers would be only to dispel foreign threats, not to enforce laws against American citizens. Before the Bill of Rights could even be ratified, however, a rebellion led by a bitter veteran tested those principles. Daniel Shays was part of the Massachusetts militia during the Revolutionary War. He fought courageously at Bunker Hill, Lexington, and Saratoga. He was wounded in action and received a decorative sword from the French general Lafayette in recognition of his service. After the war ended, Shays returned to his farm in Massachusetts. It wasn't long before he began receiving court summonses to account for the debts he had accumulated while he was off fighting the British. Shays went broke. He even sold the sword from Lafayette to help pay his debts. Other veterans were going through the same thing. They were broke, often wounded from battle, and getting little help from the country they'd just fought to create. The debt collectors weren't exactly villains, either. Businesses, too, had taken on debt to support the war. They set about collecting those debts to avoid going under. Shays and other veterans attempted to get relief from the state legislature in the form of debtor prosecution laws or the printing of more money, but the legislature balked. In the fall of 1786, Shays assembled a group of 800 veterans and supporters to march on Boston. They planned not only to close down the courthouses to prevent them from foreclosing on the veterans' farms, but also to forcibly free debtors from prison. The movement subsequently succeeded in shutting down some courtrooms, and some began to fear that it threatened to erupt into a full-scale rebellion. In January 1787, Massachusetts Governor James Bowdoin asked the Continental Congress to raise troops to help put down the rebels, but under the Articles of Confederation, the federal government didn't have the power to provide that sort of assistance to the states. So Bowdoin instead assembled a small army of mercenaries, paid for by the same creditors who were hounding men like Shays. After a series of skirmishes, the rebellion had been broken by the following summer. Shays's rebellion was never a serious threat to overthrow the Massachusetts government, much less that of the United States, and it was put down relatively quickly, without the use of federal troops, and with little loss of life beyond the rebels themselves. But its success in temporarily shutting down courthouses in Boston convinced many political leaders in early America that the country needed a stronger federal government. Inadvertently, Shays spurred momentum for what became the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. The impact of Shays's rebellion didn't end, however, at Philadelphia. Memories of the rebellion and fears that something like it could destabilize the new republic blunted memories of the abuses suffered at the hands of British troops and made many in the new government more comfortable with the use of federal force to put down domestic uprisings. In 1792, just 5 years after the ratification of the Bill of Rights, Congress passed the Calling Forth Act. The new law gave the president the authority to unilaterally call up and command state militias to repel insurrections, fend off attacks from hostile American Indian tribes, and address other threats that presented themselves while Congress wasn't in session. In addition to the concerns raised by Shays' rebellion, growing discontent over one of the country's first federal taxes, a tax on whiskey, was also making the law's supporters anxious. The Calling Forth Act allowed the president to federalize and deploy the militia whenever the laws of the United States shall be opposed or the execution thereof obstructed in any state by combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings or by the powers vested in the marshals by this act. 2 years later, in 1794, President George Washington used the act to call up a militia to put down the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794 in western Pennsylvania. The Calling Forth Act did expand the power of the executive, and Washington's willingness to invoke it showed that the new government wouldn't hesitate to use an armed force on its own citizens when faced with a violent uprising. But the law still authorized the president to call up such a force only in dire situations, and then only long enough to dispel the threat. That power would be further regulated in 1807 with the Insurrection Act, which clarified that the president could call up the military to put down a rebellion only if so requested by a state. He could send in the military in spite of a state's wishes only if he determined that the situation was so dire that federal law could no longer be enforced, or if the basic rights of the state's citizens were being violated and the state couldn't or wouldn't do anything about it. The Insurrection Act, which stipulated that the military was to be used only as an absolute last resort, would be used in subsequent decades to put down slave rebellions and prison riots. So ideas about law and order were already evolving. The young republic had gone from a country of rebels lashing out at the British troops in their midst to a country with a government unafraid to use its troops to put down rebellions. But American presidents had still generally adhered to the symbolic Third Amendment. For the first half century or so after ratification,